Goddess Radio. Welcome to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience. We are live from the Line Hotel. My name is Violeta Edelman. I'm your host, and I'm here with my co-host,
Rob Duncan, co-host, co-owner, Dolcezza Gelato.
We make gelato in Washington, D.C., and we're here on Full Service Radio. Super happy today to have our dear friend, Matteo Pistono. Matteo is a writer, and he's a meditation teacher. He lived and traveled throughout the Himalayas for a decade, where he documented China's human rights abuses in Tibet. Welcome, Matteo.
Thanks. Violeta, Rob, nice to see you guys.
Old friends here.
Yeah.
So, Matteo, I want to go back and I want to start in Wyoming. You were raised in Wyoming, and first you got involved in politics.
Yeah, through my parents. My parents were quite politically active.
Okay, so tell me about it. Tell me what you were doing and what happened there that got you disappointed with that path and then took you to a more of a spiritual path that you're in these days.
Right. Well, as I said, my parents were quite political. So, I mean, I remember my first political engagement. I was in a Little League uniform playing baseball, but before we went to play, my dad like took me to a labor rally where we were sort of protesting for higher minimum wage, and I'm like standing there with a higher minimum wage sign in my Little League outfit, like at age 8, I had that sort of within my DNA, and so that was sort of how I was raised. And then after I finished my undergraduate degree in anthropology and archaeology in Wyoming, I went to actually work on a political campaign. And I'd been working for candidates all throughout, sort of volunteering. But after college, I was the field manager for a gubernatorial campaign in Wyoming in 1994. And if we remember, 1994 was a contract with America, Newt Gingrich. It was sort of this big Republican wave. And my candidate,
Nuke, as we called him. That's exactly what we called him. He was from my county, Cobb County, Georgia, which was kind of like a tied down police state. So I know him really, really well.
Yeah.
We hid from him a lot.
Yeah. I have a funny story. Like last year I was going through Dulles, and I was just in the TSA pre-check, but just the line where, not the usual line, but just the line where they can go through a little bit faster. And who was in front of me but Newt Gingrich? And I was like, this guy has fallen down. If he's in the same line that I am at the airport, he's not like in the VIP line anymore.
He's not on the tarmac, private tarmac.
Exactly.
And that's so funny.
But anyway, so in that election, we lost, and I was so astounded that the voters didn't vote my candidate in. Like I was just, and I was a little bit like, I'm done with you guys. Like, I don't want to live among...
Of course you were a Democrat, right?
I was a Democrat.
Let's just say that.
And,
yeah, okay.
I was a Democrat, but in Wyoming, it's a very Republican state.
Right.
But in
so it's
Wyoming,
hard.
But we had a history of electing Democratic governors. Hmm. And in any case, I was like, by the first week of December, I bought a one-way ticket to Kathmandu, to Nepal. I was like, I just want to get away from these folks, and I want to just go walk in the mountains. And so I did. I just went to Nepal. I started to volunteer at a school.
This was 94?
1994, early 95. And I was just walking around in the Annapurna Circuit and in the Everest region. And I ran in, and that was where, and I volunteered at a school.
And you were teaching English?
Yeah. Okay. I just volunteered to teach English. And they said, hey, we need to put you up here in Kathmandu. And they put me up with a Tibetan family that were refugees. And that was where I sort of ran into, I was raised Catholic, but I ran into Tibetan Buddhism that way. And understanding their story, their political struggle was very, that resonated very quickly with me. But I was sort of simultaneously very interested in Buddhism, but specifically meditation practice.
So what happened? You get to Tibet, you're with this family, and you see all these atrocities that they're going through.
Well, I was in Nepal, and I just...
In Nepal, sorry.
Yeah, I was in Nepal, and I heard about all of the atrocities, but...
Through this family hosting you.
Yeah, and I was reading books about the Dalai Lama, about both the political struggle, but also Buddhism, so it was sort of going hand in hand. So I was there for a year. I ended up living in a monastery for 6 months, just studying Buddhism, studying meditation, and then when I came back, I went to grad school. And I decided to study Buddhist philosophy. So I went to London and I studied Buddhist philosophy there, got my degree. And then I went back to Nepal and India. I still hadn't been to Tibet, but I knew about all of the atrocities, as you were saying, that were committed by the Chinese since their occupation of Tibet in 1959. So then when I came back after graduate school, I came back to, I followed a woman back to Washington, D.C., of all places. So that was in 1998. And
is
that was
this Monica?
No.
Another one.
It was another one.
I was about to ask that too.
Monica?
And it didn't last so long, but it brought me here to D.C., and I got a job working... I was sort of housed in the Smithsonian, and
so many love stories now with moving, with following, and we always get those.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's me and Rob too.
We're living that too.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I follow a gringo.
Yeah.
And I met a Latina.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So
I'm not a Monica. No.
Monica's my lovely
wife. The love
wife.
Of your life.
The love of my life. Yes. And today. Is our 12th year anniversary.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. Yeah. There you go. We're still in Washington, D.C., but
Shout out with Monica. Happy anniversary, Monica, sweetheart.
So anyway, I come back here. I work at the Smithsonian, and we work on Tibetan programs. And I get, after a year here, I'm like, I've had enough of this. And I want to go see Tibet. And so I went to Tibet finally after that. And that was the first time. And I decided I wanted to live in Nepal. I started doing freelance journalism, and I started going in and out of Tibet. And I wanted to talk to the people about meditation, about Tibetan mysticism, and the Tibetans there, because I spoke a bit of Tibetan because I studied the language in graduate school. They didn't want to talk to me at all about sort of Buddhism or mysticism. They just wanted to talk to me about their political struggle. So it started, that sort of started this 10-year period of me going in and out of Tibet, where I was collecting documentation of human rights abuses. And I hooked up with the International Campaign for Tibet here in Washington, D.C. They do great work. And I was essentially feeding information to them.
You were smuggling information. That's what, on your backpack, basically, right?
Is that what you were doing? That's exactly what I was doing, yeah.
What kind of documents? Like, what did you bring back? What were the stories that you were leaked?
For the first 3 or 4 years, I was essentially smuggling out photographs. My job, if you will, was to take photographs of where Tibetan Buddhist monks and nuns were being imprisoned if they demonstrated, or even if they just held ceremonies for the long life of the Dalai Lama. They would be arrested, they would be imprisoned. So I was told where they were imprisoned, and I would take photographs of these, and they were prison labor camps, but the Chinese said they were factories. So I would take pictures from the outside I had some high-end photography gear, or I would smuggle disposable cameras into the prisons and have photographs taken inside.
That's hardcore, man. You're like risking your life with the Chinese. Don't fuck around with that whatsoever.
They don't.
How risky was it?
That's hardcore.
I mean, did you get into any difficult
situations? I was detained by the Chinese because I was in restricted areas in Tibet.
And you play the tourist? What did you do?
I played the hippie Dharma freak.
I
had hair down to my past my shoulders, and I really was like meditating all the time. I really was sort of going through the motions, but it was completely authentic as well. And you know, the Chinese mindset, the Chinese state mindset, is you do things as an organization or as a group. And so the idea that an individual would be sort of traveling around and collecting information and giving it doesn't sort of fit their...
The communist...
It doesn't fit that at all.
Machine
at all.
Ideology.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did this work between 1999 and 2008. It's a completely different situation. Now, China they're so much more advanced. You couldn't do that kind of information collecting anymore because of the state apparatus and the state control of facial recognition technology. All I had to get around was really keystroke recognition, which is essentially as you're typing, because I sent all my information out in internet cafes in Tibet and in China. So I learned here in Washington, D.C. how to take software. I took literally a CD with me. I traveled around a CD. I would go into these internet cafes. I just needed to restart the computer, to reboot the computer, and it would set me up. So I would my keystrokes wouldn't be recorded by the state police, and so it wouldn't trigger anything. And I was using a proxy server to upload. It was actually a Thai cooking website that I would upload information that you couldn't see except by a single person here in Washington, D.C. And that was where I would upload the photographs of the prisons, the reports of who was there. And I eventually wrote a book about it, about this process, about this whole 10-year period, a memoir.
In the Shadow of the Buddha?
Right, in the Shadow of the Buddha. And the reason I wrote the book was to show the lengths that individuals had to go to just to get the information out of Tibet.
Were you able to agitate any waters on Capitol Hill? These end up.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of support for Capitol Hill. I mean, a lot of support in Washington. I mean, when I would come back, as I talk about in the book, you know, I would be ushered in to the National Security Council. They would be asking me if they would be. I quote this in the book. They said, "Can we get some GPS coordinates?" This is like spycraft shit, you know? And like, it wasn't I did not consider myself like that at all. I was just trying to do good. I was trying to actually give something back to the place that was giving me so much. That is Tibet. Tibetan Buddhism was giving me so much. So I was trying to offer something back.
GPS coordinates on what?
On prisons.
On prisons.
Yeah. And on road building. Because they wanted it, they said, quote, I wrote this in the book, they want to take a closer look, meaning with satellites.
Did you have that information?
I said, I'm not carrying a GPS. At that time, GPS, that was right when GPS technology was just beginning. And so I was like, you know, no, thank you. Like, I'm not, you guys can do whatever you want with, I mean, the same thing, the Indians, when I was in Kathmandu, the Indian security services, they also contacted me because of what China was road building along the Nepali border, and they wanted to see what military capacity China had.
You know, it's funny, like the shit that could that we could get away with pre-internet, pre-World Wide Web. It's like it's amazing the difference.
But there was internet, but the first days of internet, right?
No,
well,
it was just starting when I was there.
Starting.
Not when he was there. I mean, it wasn't like a known public thing. Probably in the academia and science.
Well, it was
a bit
after that. When I first went to Tibet in 1999, there were no internet cafes. By the time I left, I mean, there's China anywhere in Tibet, anywhere in China.
But even at the beginning of the internet, it's like it's a night and day difference now.
Yeah.
Dial-up modem.
Dial-up modem. Yeah, that's what I want.
But
to
you know, also, I mean, you're right, Rob. That I mean, initially, I mean, I would smuggle. I had my backpacks and my bags. I had false bottoms sewn into them so I could smuggle because I got documentation.
So you're good. You could be a spy, or you could be working for an intelligence agency.
I always think because actually, when I came into the Lion Hotel,
are you actually a spy, Mateo? No, we're getting into it.
You have a weird name.
What does Pistono mean?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. These days, any name like Mateo Pistono, you know, you sound like, you know.
You sound like a writer, like.
No, you sound like an immigrant, right? These guys are bad.
Ooh, bad word.
Yeah.
Well, you're Italian, so you're fine. Actually, you're lucky.
When I walked in the Line Hotel, is fabulous, it's sort of, this is like set like right out of a James Bond. Like, you could just sort of see, like, you know, like
all the beautiful people.
Did this experience have any of the glamour of that? No.
Sometimes I didn't shower literally for 5 weeks in Tibet. You know, it was so cold, you wouldn't want to even take off your clothing. You would just sort of do a little
build up a layer,
wet wash type of thing, you know. But it was like
with the cloth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like my.
It wasn't glamorous at all.
What were some of the stories that do you remember the most? Are there some that were really vivid?
Well, I mean, when I talk to torture survivors, those are the ones that stick in my mind the most. You know, these people who the love that they have for the Dalai Lama and their yearning for him to come back, that they would go to prison for sometimes, you know, a decades just to be able to shout out loud, "Long live the Dalai Lama." And they would go to prison for that. And so then when I would see them after, I saw some of these individuals after they came out of prison, and I would see the literally the scars that they would have both internally and psychologically. I was recording these. I would take a video of them. Those type of things, they still sort of appear in my, you know, my dreams and stuff. It's like, it was really those type of But at the same time, the spirit of the Tibetans and their yearning for freedom and their kind of their practice of Buddhism is still so strong. It's like
still today,
even everything that the Chinese communist state is trying to do to sort of tamp down that spirit, they have been unsuccessful. And
that's not what I thought. What I read, there is more and more homogenization, and you know the.
That's probably
the language,
I mean, that also
not allowing.
Happening.
Yeah,
it is true. It is true.
I didn't know that. They weren't successful.
Yeah, there are still pockets around Tibet, and even large, more than pockets, where real Buddha Dharma, where real authentic Buddhist practice, is taking place. You know,
it's all underground, of course.
Yeah, and yes, for the most part, you know, and the other thing that has taken place since, in 2008 was when the Olympics were in Beijing, if you remember. That was a big watershed moment where Tibetans themselves really took the leap to take the information sharing of what's happening inside Tibet, and they were like, we're going to do it ourselves. So they didn't need, before it, the it was It
the
was,
international community was
the
helping.
International community.
When was the
was,
whole Free Tibet thing? Was that around then? 2008?
Well, the Free Tibet, all the stuff
big,
with the Beastie Boys.
Yeah,
the concerts that were happening here were all like, that was in 1996, I think, 97, 98 was when it was, in 1999, it was when, or actually in 2000 was when the protesters came and hung off the World Bank. That was when I was at the Smithsonian, actually, when those things were taking place. And so there was this public awareness in the West, especially through the international campaign for Tibet, through Students for a Free Tibet, through the free, as you call it, the Free Tibet campaign.
And the figure of the Dalai Lama becoming really
huge.
Big.
Huge.
Right.
It was huge. It was huge, you know. And he's actually, today is his 83rd birthday.
Will we say that this is a very auspicious day?
Yeah.
It's
happy
your anniversary.
Happy birthday, Dalai Lama.
Dalai Lama's birthday. Yeah. What else
Anything
is happening?
Else?
Yeah.
Your sister's coming in.
My sister's coming in from Mexico.
Oh, there you go.
Anyway.
She's coming in from Mexico. Should I alert any authorities?
Maybe. She's another pistono.
The spy. The Mexican spy.
Yeah. So through this process, you became very close to la creme de la creme of the, you know, higher up Tibetan Buddhist lamas. You hung out with all of them. You were there. Mm-hmm. And I know you got disappointed with politics first. And I think eventually you also got a little bit disappointed with, I don't know if Buddhism, but we talk, you and me, about, you know, the quote unquote killing the guru.
Yeah.
And how important it is to eventually get rid of all these crutches and the teacher, the guru, without going into details. But the teacher, the guru, is a big one. So tell me about this evolution or this, you know.
Maybe before the killing the guru, I mean, you got super into practicing Buddhism, and your practice was more than any Western person I've ever personally known, as far as how hardcore you walk the walk, and you come over to our house and you perform pujas. I mean, you brought out some crazy tools when we were over at the factory, when the cars crashed into our factory, and you came and did a puja to clear the spirits. And so I want you to maybe talk a little bit about your practice with Buddhism, but you know,
before
we kill the guru, tell me about your flirtations with the guru. But before that, actually, one story that I'll share that I remember and I'll always, and I repeat it. When you were doing the puja at home.
And puja means a sort of
a cleansing,
ritual,
right?
Yeah, cleansing, a ritual.
Cleansing, like smoke. And you said, what is this all about? And you put it such in layman's terms that I repeat this all the time. It's so awesome. It's like, here's what we're doing, guys. We're brand new in the factory 5 years ago. We're moving into the neighborhood. And so we're just here doing this to kind of let everybody know, both, you know, all the spirits, all the people, all the physical neighbors, all the insects, all the bees, everything here. We're good people. We're here. We're good people. We don't mean any harm. And then you put up like the black thing or the scorpion thing. And you said, but if you come to fuck with us, fuck off. That whole thing was just like, wow, that's such a good that's a warrior mentality as far as like, don't fuck around. But you know what? I don't mean any harm, and I will do beneficial to myself and my community. But don't fuck with me. That was such an awesome thing because you don't hear it, but you know that warrior way to what have a puja.
Yeah.
Broken down and that kind of simple terms was awesome. So
yeah.
Flirtations with the guru.
Well, I mean,
what about?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you know, run into Tibetan Buddhism, but even Buddhism in general doesn't have to necessarily be Tibetan Buddhism. You know, many people rely upon a teacher, right, to begin with. And especially within the Tibetan tradition, the teachers is very heavily emphasized. And so, and that was from the get-go. I mean, when I was in Kathmandu, when I started living at this monastery called Kopan Monastery, there was one very significant teacher who we were all super stoked for when he finally came. And he's still alive, fortunately. I love him dearly. His name is Lama Zopa. He was the sort of first guru I met, if you will. And of course, even like the Dalai Lama. Although the Dalai Lama is super real. And, I've met the Dalai Lama on many occasions. And when I was doing political work, mostly, and on those occasions, if I, the first time I was leading in some of Nancy Pelosi's staff to meet the Dalai Lama, I was sort of like the protocol officer from the Tibetan side. So this is what you do with this, is how this is how you might be with the Tibetans. And they always had many questions about Tibetan culture, like why does he have a red robe on, or like why does he shave his head, and so I would just answer those questions. But when I went in, I sort of bowed a little bit in deference to the Dalai Lama. Like, he's my teacher. Like, I felt as though he's my teacher. And the Dalai Lama came up to me and he slapped me hard on the back. And I had a goatee at the time, sort of a long goatee. And he grabbed my goatee and sort of pushed me back up. And he looked at me and he says, "We have work to do."
That's awesome.
So he's like, and, you know, the deference, the devotion, like, there's a place for that. And now is not that time. You know,
That's cool.
Yeah, we got work to do.
You know, I was just talking about that same thing this morning with Violetta, the whole bowing thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to detract from my personal.
I mean, the Dalai Lama I'll just say is super real.
Oh, man.
Like he's legit, you know. Yeah. So
good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Yeah, and I'll just sort of say outright, I mean, we don't have to go into detail here, but myself and the community who I was involved with for many years, 2 decades, is having total scandal because the guru was outed. You guys, your Tibetan Buddhist teacher, there were some problems there. I mean,
yep.
I was doing some research for this interview, and I opened Buddha Dharma, which is the magazine, the main magazine on Buddhism.
You wrote an article for, right?
That's coming a bit later.
It's coming a bit later, but the main article is called "Breaking the Silence on Sexual Misconduct," and I was reading it yesterday, and it was written by a nun we met so many times about the abuse, the sexual abuse that she went under with our meditation teacher.
I mean, this guy that at 5 years old went into the monastery in Tibet, and
she wrote something that I wanted to read because it really resonated with me, and I'm quoting her, and she says, "Disillusionment is not in fact the plague of the spiritual path, but rather its catalyst. Perhaps true refuge can't be found without a falling away of our false sense of security. It may be that the deepest teachings are not the ones transmitted in the Dharma hall, but rather the life experiences that challenge everything we believe to be true."
Yeah. Cheers to that. You know, within Buddhism, we rely upon the teacher a lot, you know, but at some point, you know, you maybe as a mother, my brother, so I'm from Wyoming originally. And so, like, a lot of these Wyoming isms come up in my mind a lot, and one just did, which I've never written about. But my brother, I remember, used to tell me when I was young, like when I was 8, 9, 10, he's like, "Dude, get off the nipple," meaning go out on your own, you know. And there's at some point you have to rely upon that nourishment for some time. That nourishment might be the guru, it might be the mother, but at some point you got to go out and really. You got to take part in your own rescue.
Yeah.
You know?
It's
you got to take part in your own rescue. Yeah. And so in my own experience, I learned that kind of the hard way, where I was relying upon a teacher who wasn't what he appeared. He wasn't exactly a charlatan, but he was just, he wasn't walking his talk.
That's that right there, the following the teacher, the guru, the leader, the expert, whatever, and then becoming disillusioned. That process happens, I think, in individual, true individual maturing or development, like finding your soul, yourself. That's a very recurring theme, you know.
Yeah.
Where ultimately is like Nietzsche, God is dead. John Lennon, I don't believe in Jesus. That, you know, it's like you have to get beyond those crutches, which is the thing that keeps us from going over that edge, is the fear of ultimately relying on you and yourself and your heart and your own instrumentation to tell you what to do in every single moment, second. And that's the hard, that's enlightenment kind of, I think, you know, to a certain extent.
And I think,
right?
Yeah, and I think that, like, in that what the nun wrote about the disillusionment, or even like even falling away from, it doesn't have to necessarily be spiritual. It can be like you're relying upon your mentor in work or
we
something.
We rely upon everything.
Yeah.
We rely upon drugs, we rely upon,
but when those things
relationships
fall, when those things fall away, the thing that I think that isn't emphasized enough, especially among like spiritual practitioners, but even just like, doesn't even have to be religious or spiritual. It's just like this, a kind of, we need to recognize the importance of kind of camaraderie.
The community. Yeah.
A spiritual camaraderie where it's a non-hierarchical one. There may be individuals who have more experience, and that's why they can give you advice.
Right.
But this idea...
But that doesn't put them on a pedestal just because they may have that. Because maybe they're also alcoholics.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, as far as like they have like the things that maybe they're good at and things that they're maybe not good
at. We are a mixture of shadow and light. Ooh. And that's how we are.
Humans are fucking complicated creatures, you know.
But one of the issues with religion is always this idea of being celibate. You know, it's just like not repressing the sexual
Maybe that's
impulse.
Not a good idea to repress the biological urge to reproduce. Maybe.
Yes. Just maybe. Anyway, so I think
you
this
might
is
want to remind people they're listening to the.
Oh yeah, you can do it.
That's something that I don't even know what you're supposed to say.
Oh, but you're supposed to say that word.
Full Service Radio here in Adams Morgan at Lion Hotel. You're welcome, Jack.
So this is a great time to take a break, and we're going to be back we'll with Matteo right Pistone. That's what you're supposed to say, my dear.
And the first story I want to tell when we come back is the first time I taught Rob and Violetta's daughter to meditate.
Uh huh.
She's a true Zen master, like Jedi, you know.
Oh, we know that for sure.
So I'll share that story.
Pema, come on.
We'll be back in 5.
Thank you.
back to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience on Full Service Radio. We are live from the Line Hotel. We're interviewing our friend Matteo Pistono. Matteo is a writer and meditation teacher, and he lived and traveled throughout the Himalayas for a decade, where he documented China's human rights abuses in Tibet. We were talking about that, but now we're going to talk about meditation. And you wanted to tell us a story about daughter.
So I, when I moved back to the United States, I'd been living in Nepal and Tibet for nearly a decade. I went to live in a Buddhist monastery in France, and I was getting prepared to do a long-term retreat, a traditional three-day retreat. And I went back to Nepal to study a particular ritual for the retreat. And my friend was having a wedding in Bhutan, and I went to that wedding, and I met this girl, and I was like, oh my gosh, this isn't like the idea that I was going to like go away for 3 years after I met her.
Was that Monica?
That was Monica. So anyways, it was like everything happened very quickly. I moved back. I left the monastery straight away, traveled around the world with her. We moved back to New York. Then we landed in DC, and that was when I first started writing. I was like, I don't know what I've been doing, human rights work. And then I was going to, and then I was writing. And, but when we moved to Washington, some of my friends, we were like getting together to meditate, and they were like, you should really do this more often. Like you should like teach meditation around, you know? And I definitely didn't fancy myself as a teacher. Like that's not, so this idea of just having some friends that get together and meditate. So I started doing that, and I felt
more approachable and more casual.
Yeah, and I had a thing called Wind River Meditation, and so I started teaching privately around Washington, D.C. It sort of became my job. I taught some private or public classes, but mostly just privately. And there was my God boys here in D.C. are friends with your kids and a little group of kids, and we started this group called Chill Skills.
I love that name.
Yeah. Well, the kids.
Coolest the kids, group in town, people.
Yeah. Hashtag Chill Skills. Yeah. Copyrighted already. Yeah. They, it was like the kids' meditation. And so I remember you're like, okay, Mateo will take over the kids, and then you guys go drink a bottle of wine or something downstairs. That's
what we did.
Yeah.
Every time you were upstairs with the kids, we were drinking wine with Kate.
So yeah. So your Pema, I think it was the first time that she came, and I was experimenting a little bit with sound and meditation, sound and awareness. And so we were oming three times, right? So we'd be like, om. And you'd allow that space. And that space, that silent space, is something that kids, it's not available so much these days. Space is always filled these days with either chatter or social media or whatever it is. So I was trying to create a space which was very pregnant with awareness, but not awareness of anything. Right? It was just
the present moment.
Yeah, just spacious awareness of whatever arose. So we were doing this in a group, and there was like 10 kids, and Pema, your daughter, was sitting next to me, and I was like, we did Om three times, and they knew just to sit there. And we were sitting there in the silence, this sort of very sort of poignant silence. And then Pema just volunteers, just out of nowhere. She says, I feel like wind in a flute. And I was like, right on, Pema. Like, well done, young Jedi. go fight the dark forces out there, you know? And so anyway, yeah, that was lovely time with Pema.
So let's talk about meditation. And let's start with a very basic question. So why should we meditate?
Yeah, why should we meditate? Well, I don't think necessarily everybody should meditate straight away. You know, I mean, and what is meditation? Maybe
is meditation, because, and what's the goal?
Yeah, you know? I mean, and it's, you know, there are many different methods of meditation. Some people see it as sitting quietly. Some people see it as staring at a wall. Some people see it following your breath, or looking in a candle, or chanting to the guru, or praying, or doing some sort of mindful movement like yoga or tai chi. Or there's all of these things that people will sort of call meditation. And I don't have a problem with whatever. People, a lot of my cycling friends say I meditate when I'm on the bicycle. So for me, meditation is just, it's a method that points you in the direction of coming to know your heart and your mind in a more intimate and a less and in a way that's more in line with reality. That is, there isn't a veil in
between. It's kind of beyond the conditioning, whatever the conditioning is.
We have, you know, so there's many different methods, and I've trained in the traditional Buddhist methods, both in the Theravadan tradition, which is like the tradition that you see in Thailand and in Burma, and then in the tradition, much more so in the Tibetan tradition. And so I share those around. And so, but you say, what is the point of meditation? I mean, the point of meditation is seeing things
as they are.
As they are.
Which means being anchored in the present moment.
Yeah, not the way we hope them to be, not the way we fear them to be, but just to see things as they are. And then...
And at the same time, though, but always knowing that you really, truly can't do that either, right? Because, I mean, we pick up on 1% of the visible spectrum, less than 1% on the audio perspective. I mean, I agree.
Rob, that's a segue into the medicine.
Right, from Buddhism to ayahuasca and the jungles in South America. That's where we're going.
So for 20 years, like I was, you know, more than 20 years, was pretty sort of marinated in a very traditional type of meditation practice and whatnot. And this incident or this thing that happened with my teacher sort of stripped a lot of things away from me, a lot of my idealism, and it also showed me how much I was projecting onto individuals, including him, and onto the situation. I felt as though I could see things a lot clearer, and things got a lot more grounded and basic. But at the same time, it also opened me up where perhaps I had a bit more of an attitude where Buddhism has all the answers. And I definitely don't think that that's the case anymore. They have, for particular individuals who have a particular disposition, it may. But when I open myself up to other sort of lines of inquiry and questioning, then something sort of came forward. And that's what we're talking about.
May that lesson always be there. You know, it's like, that's something that shaped me for my life with my upbringing in the Southeast with fundamentalist Christianity, where it was like this thing of, I was duped once, but I never want to be duped again. Not saying, I mean, I think it's the intelligence is to take the value from whatever systems or techniques that there are, no matter what ideology it follows, and see that there's probably in all ideologies all around the planet some really good, interesting ones that will work, you know. And so pick up all that as your tool set, but never pledge yourself to one ideology,
set
of beliefs, ever.
Totally.
Why more than anything? Because you automatically preclude yourself from believing anything else. So if you believe in one, because of rules of logic, you automatically cannot believe in other.
I totally.
And so that's like a closed system, which that, you know, in looking at it very logistically or scientifically, that doesn't make sense, because there's so many different ways and paths and techniques that are all, you know, there is validity in some of
and
them.
And I'll say that I'm not interested so much anymore in believing anything.
Yeah. That's right. That's ayahuasca talking.
Yeah, I'm not interested in trying to create a belief system,
right,
into creating a kind of I can tell you all about the Buddhist belief system. I can tell you about the different belief systems within Buddhism,
all the cosmology
and how they argue against each other and all of this. And it's just ideas. And ideas are made of beliefs are made of ideas.
Yeah.
Ideas are made of thoughts. And thoughts, as we know, are like as substantial as the clouds. So why would we attach ourselves?
Isn't it interesting? We're having a renaissance in that, casting yourself into one set of beliefs, and then it automatically pits you against all other beliefs.
Exactly.
And the thing is, as we are 8 billion close to it on this planet, technologically wired simultaneously all around the planet, that no longer is possible. We can no longer commit ourselves to one belief, which automatically pits ourselves against other beliefs. It's impossible.
Which is tribalism,
you can't do that.
One of the main issues we
cannot
have.
Do that with the technology that we have, and the ability to destroy the whole fucking planet with a touch of a button.
Yeah,
we can't do that, not because we're good, bad, right, wrong, Democrat, Republican, Christian, Muslim, because it's fucking stupid.
Yeah. But when we
be
do
smart.
It, but when we do it, you know, on an individual basis, when we decide I'm going to believe this, that has, I mean, I have to say it, it has the seeds of violence in it. Because it's where dogma arises. Right. And when you get dogmatic about things, you don't listen to another
you
individual.
You become thoughtless, right? Yeah. You become like...
And I think you do the opposite of what meditation is trained to do.
Absolutely.
Which is that you become conscious
such
and aware
it's a tricky
of the
thing.
Transient
that's,
nature
that's
of reality.
The thing. Because of evolution and for millions of years of it, it just seems like there is such an easy tendency to become tribal. Because for so long we were.
Yeah, we
and
have
so
that
there
habit
is
within
that,
us.
Exactly, the habit. The yeah. inner, the Yeah. So you know what? So we don't run out of time to get there. It's like, how does all of this that you're talking about and all of your time and decades and studying with the gurus and the lamas and meditation and all that,
mm-hmm.
you recently went down to the jungles of Peru
yeah.
and drank ayahuasca with shamans, lamas, old traditions and all that. How does the path of a shaman... plant-based shaman, South American shamanism, Amazonian shamanism. How does that compare?
Or how do you integrate that?
Yeah, yeah, to your training of Buddhism and mindfulness and meditation.
Well, I mean, you know, I haven't been a big journeyer with various substances, but I have been, you know, back in the day with mushrooms and a bit with ganja and whatnot, but I was asked, a magazine approached me to do an article on psychedelics and among American Buddhists today. And I was like, is that a thing? Like, we knew it was back in the day in the 60s and 70s. And they're like, we think it is, you know, and you should talk to this. And so I sort of, in the course of researching this article that is coming out next month in Buddha Dharma magazine, it's a nice, it's like a 5,000 word article, so it's good, you know, and it's, I was able to sort of delve in not just ayahuasca, but many various substances. So in the course of that, I befriended this woman named Spring Washam, and she has this thing called Lotus Vine Journeys, with lotus as like Buddhism and vine as in ayahuasca in Peru. And so I was interested in going down, and so, as, you know, in short, I went down there for a 2-week meditation retreat, where on 8 of the evenings, they drink ayahuasca. Ayahuasca, as many of your listeners will know, is a kind of...
or not.
Yeah, is a psychoactive brew. It's a tea. It's like a shot. You take a shot of a kind of tea that's made from boiling a vine and a leaf.
Shrub.
Yeah, and a shrub. You just boil it up.
You know that it's the only combinatorial hallucinogen on the planet? Meaning that you can eat a cactus of peyote and get off. You can smoke ganja. But the ayahuasca is only active because you combine two plants.
Right.
Interdependence.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Another Buddhist.
So I...
Keep going.
You know,
keep
and
going.
I was always of the mindset, because in Buddhism, the fifth precept, if you're a Buddhist, you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie, you don't have sexual misconduct, and you don't take intoxicants. Those are the five vows, if you will.
Very similar.
The five precepts.
Christian.
Yeah, very. But that intoxicant's kind of interesting. And so I always thought... that if I would have thought 20 years ago that if you took ayahuasca, that you're intoxicating so you don't see things clearly.
At the same time, in every religious tradition, there is a rite of passage that involves psychedelics for
sort
the longest time.
That's like, no, but in every
going
religious tradition, that actually, it's like the pre-religion, right? The religion is what the dogma that killed all those, but all religions probably come from the relationships with the sacred plants. The Buddhism, the Bonpo, right?
You know, but one thing that happens with not only ayahuasca, but also psilocybin with mushrooms and we were talking earlier about what is the point of meditation. The point of meditation is to see things clearly, is to sort of strip away our conditioned mind, our conditioned way of reacting, our habitual reaction. And through meditation, it's a quite slow process, because essentially what you're doing in meditation is you're doing something like watching your breath. But then you see how you react to when a thought of your wife comes up and you're irritated with your wife. You see how you have this sort of like immediate reaction to that thought. So it's a long process of learning how your mind is functioning, your perception, your reactions. Well, when you
psychedelics is a fast route.
Psychedelics, like ayahuasca in particular, is, so we know that substances in general tend to open up our doors of perception a little bit wider, right? William, so just when William you drink, Blake. I just drink espresso this morning, you're a bit more awake, you know, you're a bit more, when you, there's other kinds of substances, it can not even have to be substances from outside, you, emotions will do this as well. When you were fearful, we might be able to perceive more because we're having sort of this big rush of dopamine or whatever else. Yeah. But so we know that when we take certain substances, that it might open up the doors of our perception. That is the perception of like being able to smell and see and hear the five physical senses, but also what's moving through the mind. Okay. So what ayahuasca tends to do, this is my Buddhist
approach.
My
frame
Buddhist
of work.
Yeah. For understanding what happens is when you drink this tea, you go and you sit back down, and we, at this retreat, we go back and sit down and meditate, and you immediately feel like, like something is inside you, like, and it's she's beginning to work, and it's a thing. It's like a thing, and as your senses, your five senses, and also your ability to watch your mind and your emotions and whatnot, just gets cranked or just gets blown like wide open. Your doors of perception are as wide as can be. But, and that would be just by itself, just to sit there and meditate would be one thing, to hearing the jungle and just noticing the light and your breath is one thing. But then what ayahuasca does is, at the base of who we are, like of who, you know, of who, at the storehouse of your personality, like at your very core, if that's a kind of storehouse, if you will, it's as though ayahuasca opens up that valve and it all comes rushing out and you can perceive it all at once. So it's like you drink this and then 20 minutes later, it is this overwhelming sort of like Niagara Falls rushing at you of yourself, of everything that's beautiful, that's horrible, that's fucked up, that's like, it's all kinds of crazy memories, all of this. And as a meditator, like before I went down, I'd be like, I was like, yeah, so I've been meditating for 20 years. I got this. You know, if it gets really difficult, I can concentrate on the breath and nobody, you know, that I can always concentrate on the breath. That's like child's
your
play.
Your anchor.
Yeah. then if
famous last words.
Yeah. If things get like, if I can have some wherewithal, all sort of inquire within that, like who's having this experience, like all, and this, like ayahuasca had a completely different agenda because, and it's just, and it goes on for like, it's, it goes on for like 6 or 7 or 8 hours.
Yeah.
So it was, and what ayahuasca showed me, those experience, like it was the course of 2 weeks, and it was also part of like the meditation retreat. But as you guys know, when I came back, the medicine was continuing to work for like 10 days after. I came back here to D.C.
We're 20 years and it's still going.
Yeah, it sort of is within you. What ayahuasca is like showed is like essentially, and it's a psychedelic, right?
What does psychedelic mean, right?
Psychedelic it means
mind manifesting.
Yeah. But so where's your mind? Is your mind outer space? Is it the cosmos? Is it within, deeply within your heart? Who knows?
It feels very integrated.
Yeah.
It feels alive.
Oh, absolutely.
And endless.
Yeah. And overwhelming. Like, yeah.
Oh,
like
and overwhelming.
Overwhelming and scary, you know, scary, alive,
well,
mysterious,
the main thing
old,
that we haven't
ancient
really talked about
planet.
It's the experience of death, the non-dual, and the let go of the ego, which ayahuasca brings very much.
If you resist,
you're
fucked.
It's
like going into the ocean and resisting waves. You'll be beat to death.
And you know, the as the shaman down there told me, he's like, the nickname they have for ayahuasca is La Purga, right?
Because it cleans you.
The purgative.
And that purgative quality takes place on a very physical level.
You throw up, you shit. Yeah.
You cry, you sweat, you poo, you throw up, shit's coming out of your ears. Like, sometimes all at once.
Yeah, and you know, when
it's like extraordinarily explosive.
When people hear that, they're automatically like, but you know what? Yeah. The one thing always to keep in mind is like that effect of ayahuasca to Amazonian Indians physically, on the physiological level, is so vital and so important to their physiological health. Because the main sickness in the Amazon jungle are the gut parasites.
Yeah, worms.
And so you purge all of that. You clean your whole gut out on the physical level. And so you're physically, that actually also provides you're healthier. So that would be in a selection of evolution. That would be the path. More so than not,
and
right?
That purga, that purgative quality, you're cleansing that physical part. Yeah. But as you guys know, there's also like on the emotional level.
Jesus,
you're also like, it's incredibly cathartic. But it's not as though you watch it go out. You watch all of your long held habitual grooves, your habitual reactions, literally being thrown out of you. And then even more subtly, and this is where ayahuasca, so I'm not super, I've been involved with Buddhism for a long time. I've never really considered myself super trippy. I mean, I like doing the pujas and doing the smoke offerings and whatnot, but when people talked about on the vibrational level, I was never quite certain what they were talking about until...
You get it with ayahuasca.
Yeah, with ayahuasca, because I got this sense, you drink, as we said earlier, ayahuasca is like, it's unlike any other substance that I've ever taken. It's like a being. It's like you bring into you this thing, and it's she's doing things to you, and you're having. I know it sounds to the listeners perhaps super weird, but you are having a conversation with her as she's in you, right? And she's like twisting you and like twisting you out of yourself, and. What is being purged on the physical, on the emotional, but even at this vibrational level is this tendency for us not to be like the jungle. Mm-hmm. Like ayahuasca wants us to be like her.
Or like a jungle a little child.
She wants
us
to be in the flow.
Right.
She wants us when stuff needs to go out, it's flushed. When things need to be retained, they need to be retained.
The complex when they need to ecosystem recline, of the rainforest.
It's sort of, it feels like the wisdom of nature.
Absolutely. Very, this is Panchamama. This is
100%.
This is, and when I went to, the last time I was on ayahuasca, like the last ceremony we had, so the first 7 ceremonies were like almost like a block. And she had an agenda for that. And it was excruciatingly you could say painful, but the next day you feel completely alive, you know? I mean, the whole time you feel completely alive, but the 8th session was completely different. And it was like this full, I died. You know, I was crushed. I was sort of spat out in the kind of a form of a praying mantis. And then I was out in the universe for a while. But then when I came back, the whole coming back into a womb was... like possibly the most it was the most painful thing that I can ever remember in my life, for sure. And it went on for like hours.
Did you have any of the blissful as well?
At the end of this, none of the death process, actually dying wasn't the problem. It was in between, it was after the death when the problem was.
That's the bar, though.
And coming back in, and that was like excruciatingly painful. And but then when I was able to finally sit back up, the shaman was there. He was like doing all kinds of like hitting me with like the leaves and blowing smoke on me and all kinds of stuff. Like you kind of know what's happening, but it's also you're on a vibrational level. I don't know how else to say it. You can see, for example, when I say vibrational level, you can see sound.
It's synesthesia.
You can see sound.
Synesthesia.
You can see all the color spectrum of sound.
Because the shamans, when you go down into the jungles and you come in and out of sessions and stuff like that, when you talk with the shamans and you hear how they critique the other shaman's songs, they don't critique it based on what it sounded like. They critique it based on what it looked like.
Oh,
your
wow.
song here, when you went high pitch, was a little bit too ultraviolet for me. I liked more the lower tone olive green. I liked the olive green part. That's how they actually describe songs. Yeah. That's synesthesia.
Are these songs that when you drink the ayahuasca and then you're sitting there meditating and the shaman will come around and he'll sing these songs. They call them Icaros, and I guess the translation song, but it, for me, it's more like primordial surgical device.
They say it's the song that the spirits
teach, like a tapestry that they're
putting in you.
Yeah, building.
Yeah, in you and web, around you. Yeah. And I want to say this that after when they I died and I came back and it was like this, then I sat back up in this experience of light and blissfulness and floating through the universe, and it was quite extraordinary. And then I said to myself, like, I had a sense that there was a lot of healing happening, right? I mean, this was like 2 weeks on the medicine. And so, and as I said, you had this conversation with Mama Ayahuasca. So I asked Mama Ayahuasca, I said, how can I continue this healing? And she said, eat plants.
You know? That's awesome.
That's all she is. And it's a voice. Like, sometimes when she responded, it was a voice. Sometimes it was like
a thought.
Like a telepathic
voice. Right, right.
And sometimes she would drip things onto the screen of my perception. And I was like, I thought she meant like, what I'm supposed to eat, like mescaline and peyote and I was like,
salad greens.
I was like, so more medicine, like
arugula, medicine, stupid.
Medicine plants, you know? And then she just said, eat plants again. So I talked to the shaman afterwards, and he's like, yeah. And that was when he said, she wants you to be more like her. So of course, to do that, you need to eat plants, you know? And then I said, she said something about dairy or something, and I'm, you know, like, but...
Hey, don't go there, man. This, we own a gelato business. You know, there's limits here.
But Mama Ayahuasca, so this is, so, you know, and some of the listeners may have heard about this new book that Michael Pollan had out.
Change Your Mind.
Change Your Mind, which he talks about ayahuasca. He talks about the whole medicalization of, and the therapeutic use of...
There are a lot of studies
currently. And a lot of, like, stuff. You talking have brought his book and his talks and his podcast to mind, too. It's like, in somebody like Michael Pollan now in this conversation of psychedelics at a moment when NYU, UCLA, there's a lot of research happening, John Hopkins right up the way here. It's like it's happening now more than it ever has happened before, even going back to the 50s and the 60s when this started happening. Over 1,000 journals were written about it. And it's kind of right in the nick of time when we're about to blow us all up. The plants come to the rescue and say, hey, fucking idiots. No. That's not the way
plants.
To do this. Eat plants.
Fuckers.
Eat plants.
Before
people.
You blow yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like Dennis McKenna, a good friend of ours, say, you know, the monkeys are out of control on the planet. And so it's the plants that come to the rescue of the planet.
Yeah.
Could be things have getting really, really, really weird at the moment.
Thank you so much, Mateo.
Hey,
Mateo.
It's good. Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. When we first met however many years ago, it was Rob and I on a couch in Washington, and somehow ayahuasca came up.
This was how
our friendship started, was talking
based
about
this. Based on DMT and ayahuasca. I know. It's a story that I also repeat.
Yeah.
That kind of... That was proof of the relationship right there. This is a keeper.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming. Yeah.
Well, Violeta, I love you. Rob, love you.
And we good love you too.
Yeah, good luck
so
with
much,
Dolcezza.
Mateo. Good luck with
and
you and your next journey and chapters.
Thanks
and
so much.
Yeah, we love you.
Good to have you. Bye.
Ciao. Ciao.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.
Before
people.
You blow yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like Dennis McKenna, a good friend of ours, say, you know, the monkeys are out of control on the planet, and so it's the plants that come to the rescue.